Bruce Jenelson joins us, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University. Our friend previously worked in the State Department and on a Middle East peace process. He knows the region, knows the players, been involved in all of this. Good morning, Bruce. How are you?
I'm okay, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
I am, sir. If you could take a little bit of time with us this morning, because I think sometimes this all blurs into, yeah, well, people over there are blowing each other up. They've been blowing each other up for a while, but there's a lot more context than that. There's a lot more nuance than that. And if you can maybe, I guess, take us back to October, almost a year ago?
Yeah, pretty much. October 7th will be 1 year coming up on us.
And what happened then was there were a group of, tell us.
Yeah, Hamas terrorists penetrated the border of Israel pretty massively and slaughtered some 1,200 people, took a couple hundred hostage, and the slaughtering was in little villages called kibbutzes. It was all these young people at a music festival that was down in that area of Israel. And the worst terrorist attack on Israel in its history, the most killing of Jews in any single day since the Nazi Holocaust. And then, you know, in the weeks following, Israel mounted a massive war in Gaza, and it's taken a huge toll. Estimates of over 40,000 Palestinians, you know, predominantly civilians killed over there. And as you and I have talked about a lot of times, there's all sorts of other possibilities of escalation. And now, you know, we're looking at what's happening in Lebanon as a real, real risk of the war spreading even more.
So, for again, just to kind of bring people up to speed here, I'm having a hard time here, Bruce. The West Bank. What am I thinking of? The area where they came from?
In Gaza.
I'm having one of those mornings. Gaza. The people that live in Gaza are there. Why? How did they get there?
You know, this goes way back to 1948. When that whole area was colonies, mostly of Britain, and after World War II, the decision was made by the United Nations, one of its first major decisions, to partition the area into a state of Israel and a state of Palestine. And borders were drawn, at least on paper, and two things happened, to be honest. One was the Arab countries surrounding Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, didn't want Israel to be created, and they started a war against Israel to prevent its creation. And secondly, Israel, from the area that was going to be Israel, forced out many, many Palestinians who've been living there for generations. And the Palestinians call it the Nakba, the disaster. And that kind of started us where we're 75 years later on, you know, frequent wars, people living under occupation, Israeli occupation, Palestinians being kept in refugee camps. And then since October 7th, you know, it really went to the proverbial next level with all of the violence and the terrorism and the Israeli war and the risks all around on all these other borders.
I'll be honest about this, Bruce. You know what caused my problems? They put a new computer in here, and I was trying to zoom in on a map of Israel, and it kept crashing on me, and that's why I was fumbling and rumbling and stumbling so much. It's sometimes the most minor things, isn't it, that can cause you problems?
Yeah, I got to watch these technologies. When they switch my computer, it takes me a week with all my IT guys to feel comfortable
yes.
again.
I'm trying to zoom in on a damn map, and I'm sounding like I've never even read anything about this at all. What do you know about the hostages? Or how many are remaining, or are they alive or not?
Really hard to tell. Fewer and fewer. You know, there was the murder of six hostages a couple weeks ago, including an American one. And, you know, much of the protest in Israel against the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been along the lines of hostages first. You know, there's a lot of, you know, belief in Israel that, you know, let's get to a ceasefire. They don't trust Hamas, but they know how terrible the situation is, and let's bring the hostages home. And there are fewer and fewer. We don't know how many are still alive. There have been a couple rescues, and some of the rescues have, you know, brought some home. But, you know, we're right on the eve of the beginning of the Jewish New Year, the high holy days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and you can only imagine the grief and the stress for Israelis, and also the Israelis who've been displaced. You know, over 100,000 Israelis who live near Lebanon and live near Gaza have been forced away from their homes into, you know, living in hotels and the like. At the same time, you know, Palestinians are living in rubble. You know, 40,000 or so have been killed. Hospitals have been attacked. Schools have been attacked. You know, suffering, deep suffering on both sides.
I want to talk about these pager and walkie-talkie attacks. We come back if we can, or I guess it's attack. I don't know what else word you'd use for him. Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Targeted hits, if you want. Previously worked in the State Department on a Middle East peace process. 720 Traffic Now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University. Previously worked in a State Department on the Middle East peace process, talking about what's going on in the Middle East with Israel and Hezbollah and Lebanon and exploding pagers. It's easy, Bruce, for some people who want to put a white hat on one guy, a black hat on another woman or whatever gender, and make it good guys and bad guys. In this case, it's really not that simple, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. And what the Israelis did last week or so was somehow broke into the supply chain of pagers that Hezbollah and others were using. Hezbollah is the Shiite militia that's been the most active attacking Israel from southern Lebanon. And, you know, blew them up, but also blew up, you know, innocent civilians, women and children. And, you know, the Israelis think that this would make Hezbollah less likely to continue attacking them because you've shown you can get at them, you've disrupted their communications, you've killed some people. But the other side of it is not in any way saying Hezbollah has a white hat, but this can be counterproductive, that it looks like it's leading to an escalation. This morning, Israel further air attacks on Lebanon, killing more people. And it's not clear that Hezbollah is going to say, okay, I'm afraid of you, I'm going to step back. They're going to escalate. And the risk now of Israel having another war on its northern front, at the same time it's fighting in Gaza on its south and west, and then it's possibly spreading elsewhere, you know, is getting, you know, the risk is getting higher and higher now. And it's not a question of whether, you know, Hezbollah deserves it. It's whether, you know, is this working for you, Israel? Is this really working for you? And I'm not sure it is.
It seems like there's a difference between collateral damage and indiscriminate killing.
Yeah, especially with something like this, where pagers are blowing up in, you know, in shops, in grocery stores, in cafes. And, you know, there are many, you know, many Israelis that I know pretty well who are hard, you know, hawkish military strategists, intelligence veterans, who not only, you know, it's not just that they worry about the humanitarian toll. They're the ones saying to the government, this is counterproductive for us, right? So you've got two things, both the toll it's taking and the criticism Israel gets for killing innocent people. And Hezbollah is also killing innocent people. But those who are, you know, real military strategists saying, even if I were to look the other way at that, this is not working for us. It's not making us more secure.
Because you would have to imagine, and I saw the video in a grocery store of, you know, your kid's standing next to somebody that happens to be a terrorist, and all of a sudden your kid's dead because they happen to be standing to it next to a terrorist that the Israelis decided to take out with an exploding pager. That's not overdramatic, is it?
No, and it's, you know, I mean, if we were to think about this, and not just Israel and Hezbollah, but another situation, you know, somebody threatens somebody or takes a punch at them, thinking that's going to intimidate them. Well, oftentimes it leads the person to fight back and escalate, even if you're stronger than them. And right now, Israel's military has been at war for a year. You know, it's deeply strained. Its economy is strained. Airlines, you know, sometimes stop flying to Israel, not protesting politically, but because they're worried about the safety of their crews and passengers. And again, this is not a who's right, who's wrong. You know, it's just some hard-headed strategy for Israel that this is making you less secure, not more, as well as the, you know, humanitarian and ethical questions about blowing people up in grocery stores.
Yeah, you and I have had this conversation before, but it seems like the conversation is, you blow up our kids, we're going to blow up your kids, when what's getting lost in all of this is, it's wrong to blow up kids.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. Because Israelis are suffering, too. You know, they've been attacked, and people are being killed in Israel. Kids are being traumatized, even if they're not being killed. So people sometimes people look at just one side, and I think what you and I are talking about is you got to look at both sides here, and then figure out what your views are.
Yep, and again, determine the difference between collateral damage and indiscriminate killing. Thank you. Bruce, appreciate your time. As always, Bruce Jenelson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department on the Middle East peace process. And for those of you that would text in and say, yeah, well, the people in Gaza voted for Hamas, some did, some didn't. Either way, it's not what they expected. And I don't think you can justify under any circumstance your child standing in a supermarket being blown apart because they happen to be standing next to a terrorist who had an exploding pager. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish, about preventing flooding in Jefferson Parish in the future. Right now it's time for WWL for 7:45, quarter till 8, getting ready to talk to Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish, about preventing flooding. And like we saw after Francine, the total is in, I think they're talking about over 700 houses that took on water. And what can be done, somebody texted in and said that instant gratification is never going to work, that if you want to improve drainage, it must start with mitigation, retention, and stormwater storage. Real-time pumping and instant gratification will never be the solution. With that, we welcome in Mark Drews, Director of Public Works, Jefferson Parish. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing just fine, Tommy. How you doing?
All right. Tell me, first of all, since we spoke last and since Francine, what have you learned and what's come to light, I guess, about the flooding incidents with Francine?
I think what we've learned from this event, which overwhelmed the system, is we have some maps that are coming out that show us where the predominant flooding was, which will help us try to address future events such as this, so we know where the the weak points per se are. I can tell you, like, Northwest Kenner was probably the worst hit area, talking just north of I-10 to the lake. So with that said, we can take a look specifically at those areas and other areas that we see and try to work to maybe address those with additional pumping capacity if possible.
So can you do it, like, partially, or is it – because here's the deal. I'm looking at this story, and it talks about how as the rain continued to fall, you realized that you were in trouble right around 8:30. And I'm just wondering, is there ever a way that you'll be able to guarantee that houses don't flood in Jefferson Parish no matter how much you spend? Or even if you triage, as I saw one of the council people talking about, and – or go about it strategically, because I don't know if it rains that much, Mark, how you ever prevent anything like that.
Well, look, you'll never be guaranteed, because you have a mechanical system, Tommy, so no matter what I build, it does have failure points. Can we get to, say, like a 25- or 50-year storm level for the entire parish and design our system for that? Probably not, because you're talking billions of dollars, which is beyond our reach. But we can continue what we've actually been doing, especially on the perimeter. We can address the areas that are farthest away from our pump stations and take those areas and try to pump those out. For instance, we have the two projects on Veterans Boulevard. We're building pump stations at the 17th Street Canal. Those will pump directly into the 17th Street Canal, and that's an area where we have, historic flooding. But what that does, it will take out roughly 180 CFS, put it in the 17th Street Canal, but it helps the Bonneville Pump Station, because now that's another 100, roughly 80 CFS it doesn't have to take out. We're going to do the same thing at West Esplanade, help the Bucktown area take out another 150 CFS, which, again, doesn't reach the Bonneville Pump Station. So we also help other areas. We have one out in Kenner, in Northwest Kenner, where we in the Wood Lake Estates area that's under design, where we would take that area that has flooding issues, take 120 CFS and go right over the flood wall on the western end of the parish in Kenner and take that out of the Duncan Canal. And we're going to look again at other areas similar Kenner actually has a project. The Duncan Canal runs basically the length of the parish north-south. Well, they have a plan that they're just getting underway to put a pump station at the southern end of that canal, take that water and go right into the river. And it helps that area of South Canada, but also takes water out of the Duncan Canal. So there is a strategic way to try to address numerous issues that we saw as a result of this storm.
So let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. But what weaknesses, I guess, as far as you know right now, what weaknesses were exposed that could be immediately addressed as a result of Francine? Mark, if that's not a dumb question.
No, again, that's what I'm saying. You know, basically, we know where the, you know, we have a good idea already, and we'll get a better map as we confirm all the flooding of where our lowest spots are based on that, because that's typically what flooded was your lowest areas. Mm-hmm. So we know where they are based on this flood. And what's good, not good, but I mean, what the unique nature of this flood is the entire East Bank was basically blanketed with almost the same amount of water. So that allows me to say, okay, if the whole East Bank is this, where are my worst issues? So it becomes a good tool for us going forward to try to be much better off prepared for, you know, keeping those low areas dry because I basically now have a blueprint of where those areas are.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Y'all got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. We're talking to Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish. Thankfully, and again, you don't want to wish anything bad on anybody, but thankfully that tropical system is not headed this way. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish. You know, there's some political back and forth about, I guess, funding when it comes to new systems and burdens on taxpayers and 737 homes flooded, and I know that costs people a lot of trouble, a lot of money, but there were a lot of houses that didn't flood, so it's always a balancing act, is it not, Mark, between spreading the burden out and being responsible with taxpayer money and getting the most bang for the buck?
Well, it's a little even more than that because, again, it's not just drainage. We have water, sewer systems that are old that also have to be maintained. So there's always going to be a balance in that maintaining your overall infrastructure. But, you know, I think there are some good projects on the books and probably some other projects that we can develop out of this storm where we can, you know, we can make significant improvements to the overall drainage system.
And again, I'm just trying to understand this. Things that would not require extra taxes or would, or where would the money come from and how much money are you talking about?
Well, again, I can tell you the projects we have on the book that I was talking about, the two veterans pumps, those are $18 million. It's under construction, so obviously we have the funding. Right. We're looking at, I think it's roughly $14 million out in Canner, where we have the Wood Lake Estates project, the West Esplanade project at the 17th Canal is roughly $12 million. And then I believe the Canner, I'm not sure what the cost of their project is. We do have one in River Ridge, Coventry Court, that's another $10 million. So the four that the parish has on the books are $54 million, but I have $18 million already of that funded. So you're looking at maybe $36 million. We do have capital outlay applications from the states to try to get some additional funding, and I think there'll be some movement because of this event to try to fund some of those projects. Our drainage department, we roughly get around $30 million a year, you know, capital projects. So we do have the ability to use that and leverage it if we can get some federal funds, and that'll take the match for state capital outlay. So it's got to be a combination of all because, as you well know, I mean, taxes cover all of our systems, and raising taxes is just one part of it. So it is an option that we can do, but again, that we'll have to take a look at down the road.
What about alternative measures like water retention, porous concrete, those kind of things? Is that something that the parish would consider or look at, or is that a practical solution to any of this?
We've already looked at all that, Tommy. Your problem on the East Bank, like a part of this area. It's so built out. We've taken advantage when we could. We pump into Pontiff Playground. It's a logical place where we actually temporarily store water. We actually pump into Causeway Earhart Interchange. We just actually completed a pump station to facilitate that so that we can take, it's basically Old Jefferson in that area. We pump a lot of the water, take it out of the system and pump it into Causeway Earhart. The first one we ever did was at Clearview and Earhart. We dug the ponds because we had significant problems there. So, but we don't have any other large areas of green space that are big enough to make a significant impact. We basically use those. So, you know, we're always looking for ways to do storage, but with a built-out East Bank, it's difficult.
Let me try to make it as simple as I possibly can. Is there any way that, given the rainfall that happened during Francine and the concentrated area where it happened, that Jefferson Parish will ever be without risk of flooding?
There's always going to be a risk of flooding. You know, I said if we make the improvements that we're talking about and a few more, we can significantly reduce the impacts that we saw. But again, it is a mechanical system. It is subject to failure at certain points. So can we ever completely, you know, eliminate the risk? No, but we can still significantly reduce the risk and minimize the structural flooding that you saw in this event by, you know, upgrading, not so much upgrading, by adding additional pumping capacity in the vicinity of those significant areas where we saw structure flooding.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, Mark, and the information. Mark Drews, Director of Public Works for Jefferson Parish. We come back, we're going to talk to the United Way about how you can help Francine victims. We'll also check in with the National Weather Service about that tropical system. And then the next half of the hour, we'll talk with the Downtown Development District about Canal Street.